Okay. The essay itself, I think, is in two parts. The first is it begins obviously as a review of Giovanni Arrighi's account of what Arrighi calls the long 20th century, the short 20th century. So a period from 1917 to 1989 or so. The second part of the essay is where, having attempted to define or to think about finance capital, or however we would understand this concept, globalization perhaps, perhaps even the idea of the postmodern. So having attempted to understand what Arrighi and others mean by this, Jameson starts to ask himself the questions of how do we understand the ways in which financialization, abstraction particularly, are registered in cultural forms? So in other words, what kinds of culture take the pulse of this new form of financial capital? Where would we look to find cultural works that seem most interestingly to register this phenomenon? And this gets him into a set of cultural discussions. And it's that second part of the essay particularly that I wanted to spend most time on. So I'm going to skate fairly quickly through the opening sections of the essay. Partly also this is part of my own interests and also my own competencies or lack of competence in some sense. I'm not really, I can understand, I think, the arguments about financialization, and so I'm not a political economist though, so I'm not really in a position to assess or to judge exactly what Arrighi and Mandel and others are doing here. I can understand them, I think, at some level, and I hope you can too, but it's more the cultural questions that interest me. And I wanted in setting this up to say something about Jameson's, about what I think is one of the strange features of Jameson's work, which is he throws out in the course of his work hundreds of tremendously suggestive readings across the whole range of literary and cultural history. He reads advertisements, he reads science fiction, he's reading film particularly, literature, French 20th century literature. There's a tremendous amount of reading and then of close reading in Jameson, where he uses an advertisement or a book or a sentence as a way of both of, I think, of exemplifying the theory that he's trying to develop, but also as a way of perhaps of questioning the theory that he's developing. Two things to be, two points to be made here. I think that we're not obliged ever with Jameson to agree with his readings. I have a feeling that, and if you look at the reception of Jameson, you find that many, many critics don't agree with his readings. Think of his readings as almost like thought experiments in some way. What he says is that I've defined a certain notion, postmodernism, I've defined it this way. Let's find a cultural work that seems to embody, to bring those characteristics that I've described into existence. Let's then think about that work. And whether Jameson is using the literary or the cultural text as an example of the theory, or whether, in some sense, the cultural text is what produces the theory, is a really interesting question with regard to Jameson. You never feel, I think, that the cultural readings that he does are just sort of appendages to the analysis. He does most of his thinking, or a lot of his thinking, through the cultural examples. So which is why it behoves us to think about those examples ourselves and to agree or disagree with Jameson about them. So let's just rush through the opening sections if we can. He begins, as he always does, with an attempt to periodize. In one of his most famous works, The Political Unconscious, written in 1981, the opening sentence is, as two words, always historicize. For Jameson, very much that sense of understanding something in context is how in fact you get to grasp with a notion. And he wants then to identify some features of the contemporary dispensation, which is, let's say, financialization. What is financialization? And then he will attempt to place those in historical context. He says that that in the period from 1945 to 1975, and then he changes that as well. He said, maybe I don't mean 1945 to 75, maybe I mean actually all the way back from 1917 to 1975. What blocks is he using to think about the temporal changes? He says in those periods, we tended to argue ideologically. And that certainly makes sense if you think of the Cold War, obviously, as in some sense something was thought through ideologically. On the one hand, quote, the free world, also viewed then as the capitalist world from the other side, on the other side, the socialist world, the totalitarian world, but also understood as the realm of social freedoms if you're on that side. Today he says that he's writing in the mid-1990s, economic steps forth undisguised. Because he's writing in the 1990s, I think we have to ask ourselves a further historical question, which is that have things changed since the mid-1990s? I'm thinking particularly of the crash of 2008, for instance. Do we need to update Jameson's analysis here? So let's go through this a little more slowly. He starts with this question of why monetarism. And so he's describing this process. I mean, there are many terms used to describe it. Monetarism, financialization, financial capital, speculative capital. What's talked about, what's being described here, in a sense, is he doesn't use the term neoliberalism because he wants to argue that, obviously, neoliberalism is an ideological term. And he wants to define this in terms of more of its means of realizing capital. He's describing a process in which, if you think, let's go back to the 1945 to 75, this was a period of massive capitalist growth, but on the basis of industrial, vast industrial production. Often what's described by the political economists is a crisis of profitability in the early mid-1970s. The relations between capital and labor, which had been fairly compromising or fairly peaceable, if you like, between 45 and 75, for all sorts of reasons, those relationships become more antagonistic around 73, 75, etc. Capital certainly begins to talk at this point about offshoring. Just-in-time production seems to be available, and the industrial workforce of the West, which is insisting on working conditions and so on, there are new tensions which erupt in the mid-1970s, which lead capital to look for new ventures and so on, precipitating a whole new a new wave of labor unrest eventually also this crisis of productivity, which starts in the mid-70s and which is more or less still with us. But Jameson is talking about that period in the 1945 to 75 in which the capital was based on production. After that period, the perhaps the most important aspect of capital has been speculative, in which it is money that makes money. And so how is this relationship between the one mode of valorization and the other to be thought of? So why monetarism and so on? Where does all this excessive speculation come from? And so on? Why should land speculation come to the fore as dominant sectors? Turns out when he looks through this that this isn't the only time. This isn't the first time that this movement has happened. On the contrary, it seems as though the best way to think of capitalist development over a very long period of time, from about 1750s, is in terms of a certain kind of wave theory. First, there's a period of sort of ruthless accumulation. Then a period of capitalist, the consolidation of capitalist relations, the development of the of those technological forces all the way through, and then a speculative moment. So we think of the South Sea Bubble in the 18th century. You think of the crash of the 1870s, for instance. You think most notably of the stock market crash in the 1920s. We think then of the crash of 1975, the long end to this period of prosperity in the post-1945 period. So Jameson is describing all three of those. Here he is talking about the notion of ideology, which he sees as being as very, very specific, God, Manichaeism, values of the West, and so on. He goes on, though, to suggest that that today, 1990s, faced with the Reagan camp and Thatcher utopias and so on, based on the deregulation and privatization, problems of ideological analysis seem enormously simplified and so on. And then he speaks specifically of the liberating of capital for the rich, this contemporary movement, tremendous reshuffling of capital. As you probably know, the last 20 or 30 years have seen the greatest movement of capital, greatest concentration of capital in the hands of the very rich in the whole history of capitalist social relations. So I'm rushing through this because I wanted to, as I say, move to the question of culture. The question for us, as I said, is whether things have changed. Does the 2008 financial crisis suggest that if we think about what we learned in 2008, one way of thinking this was that an unregulated financial system leads both to endemic corruption and to economic collapse. That's at least what many people argued. Also, though, there's the contemporary rise for us of authoritarian nationalism, of a new round of protectionist policies, all the way from, let's say, Trump to the Philippines to Brazil to Eastern Europe. So that sense of the boundaryless world of globalized capital being reined in because of some of the crises of the past few years. Here's Pankaj Mishra talking about this, about the shift. What have I done there? Didn't mean to hit anything, but I said computer. So he's saying that it appeared only a matter of time before free trade and consumer capitalism were followed by the rule of law, the enhanced use of critical reasoning. This is the ideology, if you like, of Reaganism or Thatcherism, of neoliberalism in general. And yet it seems as though that notion has come crashing down. Jameson, when he thinks about capitalism, wants to argue for, if you like, a continuous discontinuity. How do we think about the breaks in capitalism, about these moments? And for Jameson, he wants us to think of long-term cycles punctuated, as I say, a wave theory is what he seems to have in mind. Long-term cycles in which there is discontinuity. You move from industrial production to speculative capital, for instance. But increasingly, he says, don't just think historically, think also spatially. This obviously is what globalization entails for us as well. So he says that if we position discontinuity not only in time, but also in space, and then we add back in the historian's perspective, then the local teleologies of the capitalist process can be reconciled with its own spasmodic historical developments as mutations and as those leap from geographical space to space. What one finds in Jameson's argument is a sense in which capitalism from the beginning is understood as a global process, as a world system. But that's the worldliness of capitalism is not even. It's radically uneven, it's splintered, it's divided, and it's fractured, and it moves spasmodically from one place to the other. He speaks then of these three cycles of capitalist cyclicity, or of the cycle. Firstly, trade bringing into being a quantity of money for eventual capitalization, then the money becoming capital itself, and so on. Profits, it's a condition for their maintenance, they should not be invested in further expansion. And then the break speculation, he says. For me, being South African, I tend to think of this in terms of, if you think of the period of kind of almost of institutionalized robbery in the late 19th century, in which gold is first found, and it's a kind of free-for-all, as there often is in gold. They're called gold rushes for this reason, aren't they? You rush to stake in that territory, you then quickly build. Then there's a process of which in which that that money is transformed into capital and put to end, so that mining becomes industrialized. A whole series of other particular enterprises take up, including huge diversification of the state and so on. But think in the South African context always of the specific problem in which you have advanced forces of production, but you have social relations of production predicated on race and on racism, so that there's a tension right from the beginning between the forces and the relations of production, which produces its own sorts of crises, etc. And this is a local instance, but it's part of the general process that Jameson wants to describe. What we understand is that for him, it's possible to do a kind of a world history, but that world history wouldn't be one story. It would contain within it multiple different local stories. So that it isn't as though the world story follows the story of capitalism in the US, for Jameson. This is an example of a Kondratiev cycle. It's Kondratiev, the Russian political economist, who first comes up with this idea, and we see prosperity, recession, depression, improvement, tying up with the Jamesonian notions. But just, it's that notion of the wave theory, and we see the various new technological forces that developed along the way with these dates, 1800, 1850, etc., etc. So Jameson is deploying something like this model very briefly. It's the third phase, particularly that he wants to talk about. It's that phase in which capital becomes free-floating. Here's how he describes it here. It separates itself from the concrete context of its productive geography. It becomes into a secondary abstract. Of course, money is always abstract, because in what sense is paper for us money? How do we understand it as value? It's obviously a symbolic coding, isn't it? So it was cotton money, he says, or wheat money, textile money, gold money in the South African case, or mining money in there. Now, like the butterfly stirring from the chrysalis, it separates itself off from that breeding ground, prepares to take flight, and here He plays a little bit on the idea of capital taking flight, which, of course, we speak of a flight of capital. One of the things at stake in the Brexit discussions, for instance, is will there be a flight of capital, and so on. So it begins to live a life in a new context, no longer in the factories and the spaces of extraction and production, but on the floor of the stock market, jostling for more intense profitability. Think of the subprime boom and then the crash, for instance, where it wasn't about the making of stuff. It was the value of land, of real estate, that was at issue here. I'm always struck in these debates by the way in which the quote City of London is figured as in the exchanges, because the City of London is of course a banking empire. It exists. It's a set of banks. That's what's meant by the City of London. And one of the big divisions between the City of London and the rest of the UK is that in the rest of the UK, stuff is made, things, commodities, etc. Where in the City of London, it's capital that makes capital. This is a speculative micro-economy, even though it's bigger than the whole of the rest of the British economy. So it's this process that Jameson is trying to describe. I'm going to sort of leave that part there, because this is a very, very schematic introduction. I just wanted to get to this point of speculative capital. But then ask the question that interests Jameson is, so how is this moment of speculative capital to be represented? How do we describe it? I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it, that in the 1990s, across the board of the human sciences and the social sciences, people began speaking of globalization. What did they mean by that? How do we understand that concept of globalization? Particularly, I think, because for many people, capitalism had been a globalizing dynamic right from the beginning. So that in what ways is globalization being activated in the 1990s? Has something to do, doesn't it, very obviously, with the new media technologies, with the idea of a kind of instantaneous communication, again led very often by the banks, which can make huge transfers of capital across the globe at the flick of a button, but. The notions of a virtualization, the idea of a liquid modernity, all of these notions seem to congeal in the 1990s in this notion of globalization. And Jameson is asking what forms of culture register that process. He has a tendency to move away from literature towards the more visually oriented. He argues that ours, in the postmodernism essay, he says ours is a visual age wired for sound, is the way in which he describes it. And he says that literature has become, and particularly the novel, he says, has become, the phrase that he uses is slack and flabby, and not to be, It's not capable of being renovated without tremendous creative energy, ingenuity and energy. How does one write a novel which takes the pulse of this new age? And I'm trying to think of the works published that describe it. Take a work that was quite popular a couple of years ago, John Lanchester's book, Capital. Has anyone read Capital? You have, Amber. I don't know, do you want to say anything about it or what it's about, just generally?
I studied the Good Woman, so we just did it literally, but it's about a lot of different characters in the book, and about houses as well, and how the housing market goes downhill, and it follows...
It's set at that subprime moment, moment. Yeah, so it's about, it's set in London, it's called Capital, but it's about capital in land, and about... So, but it's In some ways, it's a middle-brow kind of novel. It uses still an older, realist, naturalistic kind of convention. It doesn't have the daring or the capaciousness, if you like, of a series like The Matrix, for instance, something that can be done visually and so on. If you're thinking of fiction, perhaps you would have to think of work like Roberto Bolaño's 2066, or I don't know, perhaps David Foster Wallace's work, or perhaps Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, for instance, which attempts to think simultaneity, time and space in completely different sorts of ways. Maybe formally that's what's required in a cultural work. Jameson says that he tries to take stock of his own contributions to these debates over the time, and he says the way he puts it is that I've been able to make two specific contributions, he says, to some as yet unformulated and properly Marxian, Americans tend to use the word Marxian, Marxist perhaps for us, theory of modernism. That's what he suggests. So the first one is the idea, this is, I suppose, quite important, the idea that we shouldn't think of modernism as what comes after realism. It isn't as though you have 19th century realism, then you have modernism, and then you have, as it were, postmodernism. What he suggests, on the contrary, is that each new form of cultural expression has to be understood as a realism of its own time. What he suggests is that modernism has to be understood as realistic. It has to be understood as corresponding to a changed set of circumstances that made the old machineries of representation of the 19th century seem obsolete. How do you describe the world of the first decade of the 20th century, for instance, leading up to the First World War and so on? How do you describe the America of the 1920s leading into the Great Depression? The sense of the way in which a figure like George Eliot would have described this, you know, the idea of in some sense a condition of England novel, although Eliot was of course acutely sensitive to change, but Eliot's idea of the relationship between self and society, between individuals, the way of actually giving us a picture of a Leicestershire village, Middlemarch, as in some sense an allegory or embryonically figuring the whole of England, seems obsolete to somebody like Kafka, is the suggestion, or somebody like Joyce. So the modernism has to be understood, what Jameson is saying, as a realism. And then what happens when modernism's particular effects, its particular techniques, themselves begin to seem obsolete, out of date, no longer capable of taking the pulse. Postmodernism might also be understood then as a realism of its time. What Jameson is suggesting is that in some sense, realism and modernism are not the same sorts of literary figures. Realism is an epistemological claim. It's about the ability to represent reality. Modernism is a more temporal claim. It's about being new, etc. The novum is something that Jameson constantly describes. So here he is saying that his second contribution, though, is this one of following Lukács in seeing modernist reification in terms of analysis, decomposition, above all, internal differentiation. So he sees this particular process in terms of autonomization. What he's describing is the way in which images of the whole collapse to be replaced by these autonomized notions. How does the part relate to the whole in modernist work? You have these fractured stories. They can be very short, they can be brief, you know, they can be truncated, as in, say, Beckett. They can be huge, epic, but in the case of Joyce's Ulysses, but about one day in the life of one not very memorable figure. Implicitly, in other words, how do you actually How do you reconstitute the world for Joyce? Well, it would be a trillion pages long in some ways. I mean, Joyce can spend 200 pages describing the thoughts of a person lying in bed one morning. That sense of is that what's required to sort of plumb the depths in some way? So what is the relationship? What you see here is a movement away from the idea of a society to an idea of an autonomous fragment in some way. How does the fragment relate to the whole? And is the fragment, does the fragment become freestanding, or does the fragment still bear on the whole? This is the central question for Jameson in talking about modernism, where he says that you've got these truncated elements. In atonal music, for instance, is the whole history of tonality cancelled by Schoenberg or by Stravinsky or Alban Berg? Or is it somehow figured there in the gaps, where people begin to focus on silence, on the space between sounds? And are they in fact cancelling the history of music, or are they playing through it? If you think of the idea of the outside and the inside in Duchamp and in Surrealism more generally, across the board, this notion of the autonomous fragment, which for Jameson is always linked to an idea of the whole in crisis. And he wants to tie it up to the Lukacian theory, which we've looked at as of reification. I think a very interesting point here, he says that he wants to establish a kinship with the great phenomenon of Taylorization. In other words, the forms of organization of labor in the capitalist factories. This process of Taylorization, exactly contemporary with modernism itself. So that a division of labor now becoming a method of mass production in its own right by way of the separation of different states. And so on. So this sense of this is the way Jameson wants to think about modernism. And he's paving the way for his question of what happens when modernism becomes itself obsolete, the postmodern, or perhaps the way of registering financialization. How are these to be thought? So here his sense of what he notices, the fragment is still very much there. It's often there in the form of quoted references, of quoted reminders of the past, which we can look at in a moment. So the autonomization of the process of capital accumulation asserts its own logic over that of the production and consumption of goods as such. This again is the process of financialization understood in terms of political economy. The big question for Jameson is how that relates. And I wanted to just then move to his question of deterritorialization, because if you're speaking of this idea of the part and the whole, his suggestion in some way is the part is not simply decontextualized, not simply taken away from the whole, but begins to exist on its own. It becomes fully deterritorialized. You can't reinsert it. He suggests in some way that the whole has collapsed, and part is all that there is in some way. And so questions of sort of micro technique become crucial for him. He goes on here again to speak about land speculation and so on as one face of a process whose other lies in the ultimate deterritorialization of globalization itself. It would be a great mistake to imagine something like the globe as yet a new and larger space replacing the older national imperial ones. It's not as though we've moved from a world of nations to a globe, says Jameson. For Jameson, this idea of the globe in globalization is fully deterritorialized. It's not a space. It's a cyberspace in which money capital has reached its ultimate dematerialization. This is abstract, I think, in more ways than one for us, but I wanted to work through it because I wanted to think about specific cultural forms, architecture being perhaps the most obvious. Here from Owen Hatherley, a review of Douglas Spencer's The Architecture of Neoliberalism, for instance, we get Patrick Schumacher's comments where he says that he says of second home owners, particularly absentee owners in London, even if they're only here for a few weeks and throwing some key parties, these are amazing multiplying events. And Hatherley is obviously criticizing this. The idea of property as pure speculative venture. You're never going to live in these places. They're only there to make money. And of course, the neoliberal champions will argue that this is a good thing. Hatherley is arguing against that. There is no alternative. Schumacher translates this idea to radical free market urbanism, where all controls on the flows of capital must be removed. The market will discover the most productive mix and arrangement of land uses, a distribution that garners synergies and maximizes overall value. This takes us back to Jameson's argument that in speculative capital, the logic of the system, in a sense, trumps individual entrepreneurs or of course, workers. It's the logic of the system that operates. And I want you just to contrast, I want you to set this up as a debate, in some sense, in fact, a tremendous conflict in that most highly capitalized forms of culture. I'm thinking of architecture. So some examples from Zaha Hadid, who died last year, was it? Tremendously important architect. This is the Glasgow Riverside Museum, and we're going to contrast two forms of architecture here. The one represented by Hadid, and I want Hadid to stand for the kind of the financialized model. What we see is a building in Glasgow, which of course what we're talking about is the relationship between capital in land, speculative capital, and human capital, if that's the contrast. What is architecture? I mean, is architecture about spaces to live? What's interesting is that I find it an extraordinarily beautiful building, but you'll find that as Hadid projects these kinds of buildings globally, you find the same, not the same, but you find similar kinds of structures all over the world with the same effect. The notion of in other words, of globalization across her work. Here we have the Innovation Tower at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Again, an amazing building. It's the science and maths building at the university. Here we have one of my favorite, not favorites, which is the Bush's Chapel, which is in the Abrida Valley in South Africa. So we have a very, very poor area, the kind of the Karoo, arid Karoo in the background. This extraordinary chapel in the front. And contrast that then with this model from the Haidar Aliyev Center, which is in Baku in Azerbaijan. So a series of buildings, always not monumental in the sense of a block, on the contrary, very fluid, extraordinary kind of supple and sensuous buildings, but designed with no, it seems to me, with no sense to think about the human capital implications of a building like this. These are spectacles. They are valuable. The implicit audience in them is not the local community, who mostly stay away or else come to gawk as though they were tourists in their own land, as it were. And I wanted just to contrast, if you think of this kind, there's lots of this kind of building. Zaha Hadid is one particularly consecrated example. But contrast that, say, with another British-based set of architects, Caruso St. John, for instance, when they come to remake or to take over buildings. Look at theirs. It's hard to even tell what it is. This is the Centre for Contemporary Arts in Nottingham. You have, in fact, you have to point it out. It's part of the process. You see immediately that Carusis and John, the company, are interested in a sense of both blending, but also of in a sense of revitalizing an existing urban scape. Here's their Newport Street Gallery, which is the Vauxhall, South London, the gallery designed to house the works of Damien Hirst, for instance, but again built onto the side of this railway siding, and on the other side, very similar. And this is an area of fairly poor, run-down area of London. But notice the kind of the replication of the existing forms of let's say the way in which this doesn't arrive as a kind of an explosion on the existing space. It doesn't cancel out the previous social relations, it seems to me. I mean, if I were properly Jamesonian, I would describe this quite neutrally, as it were. I find it quite hard to do because obviously I have so much privilege this one over the Zaha Hadid. Jameson's skill in some ways is in presenting the two almost neutrally. Not quite, I think, but Jameson's, sometimes his judgments do come through. A final example for Caruso is the Liverpool Philharmonic building. Obviously an old factory warehouse redesigned. But that sense of what is the relationship between popular culture, elite cultural forms, and forms of living. That's what seems, Caruso and John are particularly concerned with that question. Let's look, if we can, at Jameson's analysis of a Norfolk Southern. What is the name of the big logistics and transport person?
Eddie Stobart.
Eddie Stobart. So the new part Southern are the Eddie Stobart of the UK. Thank you very much. Well, as I drive up from London each morning, I actually count the number of Eddie Stobart vans and trucks that go past. In fact, sometimes it's more than cars, but because there are so many. But here's Jameson talking about Norfolk Southern advertisement, and he let me show you the advertisement first of all. So it's an advertisement from the early mid 90s.
Depends on its bounty, both natural and man-made. Finding new ways to get these goods to market more efficiently and reliably is the noble pursuit of Norfolk Southern, the thoroughbred of transportation.
Thoroughbred of transportation. So Jameson reads that advertisement. What kind of a perpetual present is this, and how to disentwine an attention to the persistencies of the same from that shock of visual difference alone entitled to certify temporal novelty? Metamorphosis, he says, as violent and convulsive yet static variation, certainly offers a means of holding onto the thread of narrative time while allowing us to disregard it and consume a visual plenitude in the present instant. Yet it also stands as the abstract monetary container, the empty universal tirelessly refilled with new and shifting content. Yet that content is little more than a fullness of images and stereotypes. He focuses on the use of the horse, for instance, on the idea of the mutation of the horse into various shapes. Goes through through the history of Western art. He says that the collective transformation, not of riches into dead leaves, but rather of banalities into elegant visuals self-consciously offered for the eye's consumption. This particular commercial advertisement, it's worth noting, is regularly screened during an hour-long program of financial news, where, unlike the accompanied automobile and hotel promotions, it's clearly meant to designate investment opportunity, investment of images promoting investment of capital. He wants to contrast the way in which the autonomized detail, the horse which turns into the segmented shape, on the one hand, quasi-organic, it seems to take on various forms of flowers, of shapes. On the other hand, of course, massively technological. It's metal plates and so on and so forth. So you've got natural, social, industrial put together as a sort of narrative logic which plays itself out through that way. All of which use quoted images from the history of representation. You want to contrast that the detail in that work, the autonomized fragment, with a different kind of autonomized fragment. He gives us the example of Stan Brakhage, the British avant-garde and non-narrative filmmaker. Have people seen Brakhage's films? I mean, I don't know if they're looked at. The one I'm going to show is Mothlight from 1963. This is a silent collage film that incorporates real-world elements. Brakhage produced the film without the use of a camera, using what he then described as a whole new film technique, collected moth wings, flower petals, blades of grass, and pressed them between two strips of 16mm splicing tape. So the resulting assemblage was then contact printed at a lab to allow projection in a cinema. The objects chosen were required to be thin and translucent to permit the passage of light. What's interesting is here you'll see the fragment. What's being described, what's being pictured, I suppose, it's a moth. It's light and a moth light. What is the relationship of the fragment, which has been torn from its whole? Think of how narrative works in this non-narrative piece, of how, in other words, the part links to the whole, of how you cannot create that narrative of the relationship between part and whole, or absence and presence, in the Norfolk advertisement, it seems to me. You can probably create it here still in Brakhage. So it becomes a meditation on death, I suppose, at some level. The whole thing is only about 4 minutes long. I was going to say it's 104 minutes long, but you're pleased to know it isn't. Just about 4 minutes. What Jameson says is that this practice could be described in analogy with music as a deployment of quarter tones, of analytical segments of the image which are somehow visually incomplete to eyes still trained for and habituated to our Western visual languages, something like an art of the phoning rather than of the morpheme or the syllable. So Brakhage's practice shares the will to confront us with the structurally incomplete, which however dialectically affirms its constitutive relationship with an absence, with something that is not given and perhaps never can be. That gap between part and whole, or presence and absence, he suggests, which was there in the work of late modernist artists like Brakhage, which is no longer there. He gives us the example of Derek Jarman from The Last of England, a different kind of text. But I was thinking of how we would describe What Jameson calls, what is the culture of financialization? The example that I thought of was Kendrick Lamar's Humble, for instance, which I'm sure all of you know much better than I do. But if you look at the way in which the history of visual art is pictured here, the way in which the discourse of authenticity arises and is meaningless, etc., in this work.
We get a weakness. You gotta see this. Yeah. I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances. Vanessa nickel with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this. Parmesan with my accountant lips, in fact I'm down in this. I'm saying with my food, it tastes like I play for the analyst. Girl, I can buy your Westy girl with my base stuff. Oh, that pussy good, won't you say that on my taste buds? I get way too petty, won't you let me do the extras? Pull up on your block and break it down, we playing Tetris.
Not only because, of course, Lamar is now funded by BlackRock Investments, a huge transnational corporation, which it's not only for that reason that one wants to think of his work in relationship to financialization, according to Jameson. I think there are so many ways in which the quoted past, the discourse of authenticity, in the essay where he says, I'm sick of photoshopping at one point, and then gives us a sort of momentary images, both of his own face, photoshopped and not photoshopped, but also then of a young model, etc. But that sense of the way in which I think the way in which the fragmentary citation of the past can't be connected to anything. It doesn't exist as an absence any longer. I mean, the negation of this text, I suppose, could just be shown, internally in music through contrast with Gil Scott Heron's "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." This is 70s, it's still in the time.
There's no such thing as a perfect writer. This is why I use Grammarly to check my work.
If I'm putting commas in the wrong places, that...
So at the level of popular music, but more than just popular music, I think that we want to talk about. There's something about the forms of contemporary social existence, the way those are experienced, yes, but also the way in which structurally they are, which obviously we see Scott Heron, we see the protest in Scott Heron, we see that moment of the negative dialectic, if you like, of absence in the late modernist works, in Brackage, in Scott Heron. For Jameson, that moment has gone. Something else is being registered. I'm putting this too schematically and too quickly, but that's the way in which I'd like you to think about those things. When you're rereading the Jameson, if you would, for tomorrow, try and just look up some of the references that he gives. I mean, look up, watch the Brackage properly, listen to the music that Jameson refers to, and you'll hear or see some of the things that he's talking about. I hope. Thank you.